Welcome to the podcast series Talking Success, connecting the global fintech community. I'm Stacey Jafta, and today I'll be chatting with Richard Leftley, founder and CEO of Microinsure. Microinsure has recently gone through a merger with STP Group and is now Microinsurance Company. They provide an end-to-end solution to the needs of those that are unserved with the safety net that insurance provides. Hi, Richard. How's your day been so far?
Oh, it's good. Thank you. Yeah. Unusual times, of course, living through pandemic Britain. But it's nice to be in one place for a period of time and not be getting on an aeroplane.
Yeah, it's a very, very different way of living, just for those that are used to being on the go 24/7.
Yeah, exactly. I've got back into running and doing all sorts of things that I had put on hold because traveling around the world just makes those things difficult. So it's kind of, there's certainly some upsides.
I feel the exact same way. I have been meaning to start like a full-blown workout routine, and this is the first time I've been going for 2 months straight. That's never happened in the last couple of years. But I feel like with lockdown and having to be put in this self-isolation, it forces you to think about the things that you've been meaning to do and how to look after your body and just slow down the pace.
Absolutely. Yeah. And nice to be with the kids as well, for them not to be able to disappear at every opportunity.
I can only imagine. Anyway, let's just hop right in. I would love to hear about your journey to building your career and business.
Sure. So, I mean, I've done two jobs, really. I'm 47 years old, but I started off as a reinsurance broker with a company which is now Aon Benfield. It was the Benfield Group originally. I did that for 6 or 7 years. And I remember kind of looking at my boss when I was about, my late 20s and thinking, you know what, I really don't want to end up doing that guy's job. Nothing against him as an individual. I think he's a great guy, but I just didn't fancy doing his job at some point. And I had become fascinated in my 20s as to why it was that people in Africa and Asia just simply didn't buy insurance. When you looked at the statistics, 97% of people living in Africa and in Asia simply didn't have a single insurance policy. And yet, when you open the newspaper, there's kind of just, story upon story about the kind of risks that they face, the risks from natural disasters, the risk from just that are inherent in terms of living a kind of low income lifestyle, right? Disease, lack of education, poor nutrition. And so there was this, okay, so how do we put in place a safety net, which as people work their way out of poverty, moves up underneath them? And so that was really the genesis for Microinsure. And so for the last 19 years, I've been building out this company bit by bit. Started off as a kind of not-for-profit. It was way, way before fintech and digital and all the things that people now talk about. Back in 2002, it was the height of the HIV epidemic. Certainly kind of starting within the microfinance movement was really the only place to start in terms of being able to fund the business, but also in terms of being able to gain access to the kind of client base that we needed.
And then
over time it's grown, and evolved as a business. Here we are now, nearly 19 years later, serving kind of tens of millions of clients across Africa and Asia.
That's so inspiring. Can you give me a quick elevator pitch on Microinsure?
Certainly. I think Microinsure exists because insurance companies have been around for decades, and yet people don't have access to insurance. And so what we've done is we've been filling the gaps. We realized that, providing insurance to the low income market needs to be a kind of B2B model. So we distribute our products through organizations like banks, mobile phone companies, mobile wallets, ride hailing, a whole range of organizations that reach out to large numbers of the target market. And so we work in partnership with those organizations in a B2B kind of model. And what we do as Microinsure is we design the products, we design the customer journeys, and then we get about selling the insurance through a range of kind of digital and call centers and what have you. We collect the premiums, we educate the consumer, and we help them get their claims paid. And then, of course, we also work with insurance companies who ultimately are the balance sheet and the regulated entity. And so we're that gap filler, we're that filler between the guys that own the clients and the guys that own the balance sheet.
Awesome. You're all the way in the UK. How did you learn about what was going on in Africa and Asia and then come to the realization that this was a product that was needed?
Yeah, well, I mean, I had grown up, I guess, my parents were building airports and large kind of civil projects in the Middle East and in Africa when I was a kid. And so I'd kind of, I wouldn't consider myself an African, but I'd certainly been exposed to, you know, to what the life of a someone living in rural Africa looked like. You know, I had a good understanding of that. You know, in the early 2000s, I'd become fascinated, as I said, you know, working in the city, working in London, about why it was that people didn't buy insurance. And so I took a, you know, 2-week kind of voluntary, one of those kind of voluntary projects where I volunteered my time. I took a couple of weeks, a whole day, and ended up in rural Zambia, in the Copper Belt, northern Zambia, kind of, you know, fully embedded into this kind of local village. And what I discovered was, you know, that the people were kind of constantly kind of cycling in and out of poverty. So there was this lady in the village, and she had started off her life in the village. She'd ended up, you know, being a school teacher with her husband, who was a security guard in the capital city in Lusaka. And they had an apartment and a motorbike. And then here she was back in the village with virtually nothing, you know, and I was just really surprised by this. You know, I had this kind of very simple idea about kind of poverty and how it worked, and that, you know, you were either poor or you were rich.
Yeah.
And it isn't like that. You know, people kind of cycle in and out of poverty. And what happened to her was, you know, husband had got sick with HIV, and then they'd spent all their money on his treatment, and then on the funeral, and here she was. And, you know, and she described her life a little bit like a game of snakes and ladders. She said, look, you know, I'm just trying to work my way out of poverty. And she understood that bad things do happen. She wasn't looking at me to wave a magic wand and stop bad things. But she asked me, you know, like, could you not help me so that when bad things do happen, I don't fall all the way back to the bottom? And that's where, for me, this kind of light bulb went off in my head. And I said, well, that's what insurance does. That kind of light bulb went off in my head, where I kind of realized that, okay, you know, people in Africa don't have insurance, and yet they're also living in poverty. So, you know, are these things connected? You know, is it possible that, you know, people are kind of constantly striving to work their way out of poverty, and then disaster strikes and they get pulled back? And so, you know, that's where microinsurance had its origins, was in that desire to provide a safety net to people.
Taking it one step further, how do you understand exactly what the consumer wants in a market you're not a part of or don't relate to?
Yeah, it's kind of difficult. And in the early days, you know, we did an awful lot of kind of market research, you know, and kind of trying to embed ourselves in the community and understand. And I think that is useful, you know, understanding how people use money, you know, asking questions around, okay, so when you get sick, where do you go? You know, how much does it cost? You know, and so understanding some of those things are useful, but only useful up to a point. And there comes a point where, you know, if you ask someone, so you know, what do you want from your insurance product? They kind of look at you blankly because they've no idea what you're talking about, right? You know, and so there is a kind of point where, you know, you need to stop asking questions and you need to just, you know, take a bit of a leap of faith, launch a product, which is kind of as best as, you know, it's kind of in the right ballpark, I guess. And then once it's been out there for a little while, we've then found, you know, that's where you get the best answers. So that's where after the product's been in the market for, say, 6 months, where people have seen it working in practice, they've seen a claim be paid, maybe they've even seen a claim not be paid. And then going to them and saying, okay, so, you know, what is it you like about this product? What is it that you think needs to be improved? And that's where you get really good feedback.
There are also so many options when it comes to insurance. And as you mentioned, you got blank looks when you asked, what is it that you want? It's pretty complicated to understand exactly what you need. How do you educate your potential customers and get them to a place where they feel the need for insurance?
Yeah, we've done a lot around education. In the early days, we did comic books. We did, you know, we used to send people out into the market to do kind of plays almost, you know, like kind of act out kind of scenarios, this terrible thing's happened to me, but don't worry, I had insurance, you know, and it was a kind of very basic form of advertising. And basically none of it worked, you know, all of our research.
Not think that sentence was going in that direction.
No, it just really didn't work. We didn't really see any any change in behavior. You know, we tried radio, you know, we tried doing things on radio shows. We even did TV adverts, you know, none of it worked. And basically what we found, the only thing that works is with insurance is getting it into people's hands, you know, getting it into people's hands, letting them use it. And what we found was that once someone has made a claim in a community, the demand for insurance dramatically increases. So, you know, what we tried to do in the early days was to kind of get insurance out there almost for free, you know, so it was almost kind of like, okay, we need to kind of convince people that insurance works for them because people have so many negative impressions of insurance, right? I mean, you know, I think it's true. No one wakes up in the morning wanting to buy insurance. And if you're poor, you really don't, right? Like, I mean, there's a million things that, you know, you need to buy or spend money on before you buy insurance. And so, convincing people of the need for this product is a really hard sell. So with telcos, I mean, what we got to a point, I think, in about 2007, 2008, where we realized that we needed to go bigger, right? We needed more scale. We needed to go beyond just the microfinance organizations. And we were trying to work out what kinds of organizations, what kind of B2B partners to work with. And we soon realized that, you know, you needed organizations that had a large number of clients that had, you know, that were trusted. And trust is actually about frequency of use, you know, about how often you know, so when you top up your phone, it kind of works and therefore you trust that brand. And it needed to have some kind of mechanism for payment, whether that be mobile money or airtime deduction. And so telcos were just an obvious partner. But what we hadn't realized was that they were also a fantastic way of educating the consumer because what we got to was, okay, you know, the telcos at this time were starting to see a decrease in their revenue because people were switching to smartphones. And so they were topping up less, they were using the internet more. And as a result, the telcos were interested in trying to use insurance as a way of convincing people to top up more with them. So people had two or three SIM cards. They were topping up, say, $5 across two or three different networks. They might be spending $2 on average with each network. And what the telcos realized was that if they offered free insurance in return for a change of consumer behavior and in terms of a change of customer loyalty, so the more you top up, the more free insurance you get, that actually this was a kind of compelling business case, right? It made sense for the telco to give away the free insurance, to pay for the insurance, and because the customer was changing their behavior. I mean, we said earlier, you know, no one wakes up wanting to buy insurance, but they do wake up worrying about the risks they face.
Yeah.
And if you offer them, you know, a solution to that risk, then they'll change their behavior accordingly. And as a result, this enabled us to get insurance into the hands of millions and millions of people. I think we signed up like 20 million people in 140 days in India.
Through
these telcos. And then, of course, what that enabled us to do was to demonstrate the power of insurance to these millions of customers. And when they had that insurance, when they saw the power of insurance because, you know, someone in the community needed to make a claim, that then kind of opened up an opportunity for us to then upsell insurance into those communities.
How was scaling at that point when everything just blew up in a matter of weeks?
It was terrifying, you know, like, I mean, we had no idea, right? Like, so when we first started working with the telcos, we started in Ghana with Tigo in 2009. And, you know, we were given the kind of opportunity to go to like 100,000 customers and we onboarded them. And, you know, the idea was, okay, if these guys change their behavior, you know, if they top up more, if they become more loyal, then we'll be able to kind of scale this up from a pilot test. And within a couple of weeks, you know, we got a phone call from Tigo, kind of like, okay, it's working. And we were able to go to the customer base. And then, you know, within a very short period of time, you know, we got, you know, a couple of million clients in Ghana. And this was at a time where kind of quite literally, I think we doubled the size of the insurance market in Ghana within about 12 months. You know,
kind
of 30 or 40 years of insurance companies being around in Ghana had led to kind of like about a million customers in Ghana, you know, and here we were, you know, this little kind of startup, you know, working with a telco and, you know, within a relatively short period of time, we got another million clients to sign up. You know, and then you go to a place like India where, you know, a telco might have, you know, 50 million customers or more. And suddenly, you know, 20 million of them are, you know, signing up. And we had no idea whether our systems would cope, right? Like, I mean, we'd never tested our computer system.
I could not imagine.
You know, we thought that they would do it, you know, but we had no idea. And we were getting like, you know, kind of several million clients a day signing up.
So what did you do, Richard? What did that period look like?
It was pretty frantic, you know. We were, I mean,
headless chickens.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, at that point, you know, like cloud computing was, you know, was really quite new, you know, so kind of, you know, nowadays it's quite normal for your servers to be hosted by Azure or, you know, AWS or whatever. And so, you know, being able to flex your kind of storage capacity kind of according to the volume of traffic, you know, is fairly normal now. But, you know, like this was back in, you know, the kind of mid 2000, you know, 2010, 2011. And at that point, you know, we were hosting our own servers in, you know, in data centers. You know, that was the model. And just buying enough server space, buying enough rack space quickly enough was a massive issue. You know, like, and we were kind of being woken up in the middle of the night with kind of text messages telling us that, you know, we were dangerously low on storage capacity because, you know, India was awake and signing up, you know, and so, yeah, it was pretty frantic. I mean, just buying enough rack space quickly enough was the challenge.
When did you guys go from not-for-profit to for-profit?
Yeah. So, I mean, in the early days, you know, back way, way back in 2002 when we started, and it was far too early, you know, to go to market and try and raise money for, you know, selling insurance, you know, fintech, insurtech, these weren't terms, you know, mobile phones were even just kind of like really only just really getting traction. Mm-hmm. And so the only way to do it was to be a not-for-profit. And we were lucky enough to get this kind of, you know, big chunk of change from the Gates Foundation. And that kind of got us started. But then, when we started to work with the mobile phone companies in, you know, 2008, 2009, we soon realized that funding the business through donations from these kind of not-for-profits just wasn't going to work because it took maybe 6 months or 9 months to convince a donor to give you some money. And of course, the speed at which telcos move is measured in weeks, not months. And so we, you know, there was this mismatch where the telcos would say, look, you know, we want to go ahead and we want to launch in 8 weeks' time. And, you know, if we couldn't raise the funding to kind of be able to support that and expand into that new partnership, then we ran the risk of kind of losing, you know, losing the opportunity to expand. And so that kind of almost forced us to go raise, you know, kind of commercial money. And so we made that transition around the same time, around, you know, 2007, 2008, as we were getting into this kind of, you know, very rapid scaling model. And of course, the investors were happy because at that point, you know, scale was, you know, startups that were able to scale quickly were, you know, that was the model, right? Like that was the Amazon, the kind of, you know, the Uber type model. So they weren't too worried about the bottom line. They were worried about kind of scale.
Yeah, you initially got $25 million in funding from the Gates Foundation. If a listener is in their beginning stages of building a business, what advice would you give regarding funding and how to go about this?
Oh, there's a funny story about that. I mean, it's so for us, I mean, for me, you know, we were funding the business through these donations. And I got to a point where I realized that we just needed to get kind of a, you know, a really big check, right? So we were funding the business through like very generous individuals who were kind of, you know, giving us money, but in small chunks. And so we never really had more than about a 12-month kind of runway. And then, you know, I realized that we needed to get like a longer runway than that. I realized that there were very few individuals or very few foundations in the world that could cut a check of the kind of size that we needed. And so I was very, very focused on trying to get to the Gates Foundation. I actually went as far as moving my family to the States because I realized that trying to do this from the UK was going to be very, very difficult. You know, insurance wasn't even on their radar. I mean, they were interested in financial services for the low income market, but they were more focused on kind of credit and maybe savings, but they weren't really interested in insurance. And so, you know, I set about convincing them about insurance. You know, that led to them kind of issuing an RFP and then, of course, applying for that RFP. And my initial kind of submission to them, it turned out, was too small. So they turned around and said, you know what, kind of, we want to give you some money, but like you're asking us for a relatively small amount of money. You know, I was asking them for a couple of $1 million. And they said, you know, we just can't, I mean, this was before the financial crash. And so they were needing to kind of disperse, you know, bigger checks, right? In order to kind of maintain their—
What a good problem to have.
Yeah, good problem, right? And so I just moved to decimal place. You know, I'd ask them for $2.5 million and I just moved it.
Just moved the decimal place. I love that. So for all you listeners out there, just moved the decimal place.
Yeah, well, it was one of those very surreal meetings where, you know, I went in and I'd asked for 2.5 and I came out with 25. And it was terrifying. I mean, at that point, you know, our kind of global expense budget was, you know, was $250,000, right? And the next year I had to go spend $5.5 million. So it was this huge jump, and just hiring that many people was a challenge for me.
Besides moving the decimal, and I mean this as a joke, what advice would you give to somebody? I'm coming to you, Richard. I need some advice on how to go about this. What do you say directly to me? Obviously, each business is different, but do you have any general information or steps somebody can take?
I think it's really important to be very clear about, in your own head, about what you're doing, right? So for me, it was like, I mean, if you go to the Gates Foundation or you go to someone and say, you know, I want to sell in, you know, insurance, and you start getting into the details of how you're going to do it, you've kind of lost people. I think what you need to explain to people what it is you're doing and what that's about, you know. And with the Gates Foundation, I mean, you know, they were interested in finding interventions that could, you know, dramatically change the world that we live in, right? I mean, the Gates Foundation is an ambitious kind of foundation. They want to change the world, right? And so, you know, it was about finding that I don't want to use the word story because it sounds like something which is fictitious. It's not fictitious, but it's, you know, it's that story about snakes and ladders, right? It's that story of, okay, so kind of, you know, the bigger picture is there's millions of people in Africa, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people who are living in poverty, and they're trying to work their way out of poverty. And, you know, you as the Gates Foundation are doing a whole range of really cool stuff to help them do that. But, you know, when disaster strikes, they kind of slip back into poverty. And it's not about, you know, with someone like the Gates Foundation, it's not about telling them a story about an individual. It's about telling them a story about society and about how society will change for the better, and how that's going to be kind of measurable in very clear ways. And I guess I was in the right place at the right time. Interestingly, I mean, if I had my time again, and you know, if you took me back in a time ship, I think it was fantastic that we got the money from the Gates Foundation. But it was also a very challenging time, right? I mean, you know, doing a startup with money from a donor is, I think, an extremely challenging proposition. Because
how come?
A donor needs to know, if a donor is going to cut your check for, you know, for a 5-year project, they want to know what you're going to do in detail. Mm-hmm. What countries are you going to go to? Who are you going to work with? How many clients are you going to serve on, you know, by this date, by this date, by this date? And they want it all mapped out. And quite frankly, when you're doing a startup, you've got no idea what it's going to look like in 6 weeks' time. All that you know is that you're going to try a bunch of stuff. You're going to keep what works, and you're going to quickly learn what doesn't work. And then you're going to, you know, evolve and evolve and evolve. And if you can do that, then you'll survive. And of course, that doesn't fit with a donor model, because a donor wants to know where you're going to be in 1 year, in 2 years, in 3 years. And if you don't hit those targets, then they've got a problem. And so, you know, that's a really big challenge. And trying to fund a startup, you know, there was a lot of tension. There was a lot of tension in the relationship, because they were, on one level, they were happy with what we were doing. Clearly we were making progress, but on the other hand, we weren't hitting the targets that we'd agreed with them. Right. I mean, there's no ways around that. And so they were pretty disappointed with where we were.
We chatted a couple of weeks ago about going digital too early. Can you touch upon this a little bit more? And how can someone predict when the right time is? Is there a formula? What do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are all fixated with digital, aren't we? And I do think it's the right way to go. But I mean, if you go out there into the field, into reality, I mean, there's still an awful lot of people that are using gray screen phones, right? So, you know, I mean, I was listening to a discussion yesterday by the GSMA about their mobile money. You know, they were looking at kind of the spread of mobile money in Africa. And it's still true today that most people are still using a USSD rather than a smartphone, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's still also true that most transactions are in cash, not yet in digital. And I think that will remain the case. I mean, of course, there will be this kind of inevitable march towards digitization, towards mobile money. And that's good, and it should be encouraged. But the reality is that most of our transactions are still done through airtime deduction, right? Like the old ringtone model, as opposed to through mobile money. And the reason for that is because, you know, majority of transactions on mobile money are still kind of cash in, cash out. You know, you put some money on a mobile money wallet to pay a specific thing, you know, to pay a bill, to send money to a friend, or to buy airtime. Those are 80% of the transactions on mobile wallets today. But you don't store money on your mobile wallet overnight. And therefore, you know, this kind of like nice romantic model of I sell insurance to someone, or I sell, you know, some kind of financial service to someone, and then I can use their mobile wallet. There's an awful lot of mobile wallets out there, and the majority of them don't have any money in overnight. So I think we have to sometimes, I think we as an industry get kind of impatient with the reality of our clients' lives. And we need to kind of, perhaps sometimes embrace the fact that, yeah, of course, we need to be digital. We need to be digital in how we communicate with our clients, because that's the only kind of, that's the only way we can do it within the cost base that we have. Mm-hmm. But we also need to enable people to have a degree of kind of old school analog gray screen, because that's the reality of where they're at.
Yeah, you sold Microinsure and recently bought the company back. Are there any changes or new products we can expect?
I think it's always been
I forgot about that.
For me, the story is, we've been building out this organization, and it's been very focused on solving the challenges of distribution, which I fervently believe lies at the heart of being successful when it comes to selling insurance to the poor. And we've been very, very fixated on that. The challenge is that the kind of the economic model, the revenue model, is a little bit broken. So it's a challenge to be as profitable as you should be when you are just this kind of intermediary. And so you need to end up being the balance sheet. You know, you need to end up eventually becoming the insurance company. And my kind of original plan was to kind of bring on board some of the big, you know, the big kind of global insurance companies and become the specialist arm, the kind of micro insurance type division within a big insurance company. But the reality is that, and we tried that, and that was the route we were going down. But the reality is that they're very big insurance companies just crush the life out of innovation. I'm sorry to say it, but they're not designed to really embrace innovation. They're designed to be stable, very stable businesses that kind of lower the risk associated with doing insurance. And so it became very evident that we could end up within these organizations, but lose all the ability to kind of innovate and to create products and customer journeys that really work. And as a result, we bought the business back about a year and a half ago now. And that's enabled us to kind of continue our journey. But I'm still convinced that we need to become an insurance company. And so, you know, the last year we've been kind of considering ways to do that. And I think kind of in the near future, we'll be able to announce some news that will see us kind of make that transition from being a kind of specialist distributor to being a specialist creator of product and owner of product. And that will be exciting, because it will mean that we're not limited to what products we can convince insurance companies to give us, but instead we'll be able to put our money where our mouth is and actually bring products that we can imagine to market for the first time, and then live and die by their success, really. So.
That is exciting. I'll definitely keep my eyes out for that. Richard, thank you so much for being a part of this episode. I loved getting the chance to chat to you. Thanks again.
You're welcome. It's been great fun.
Where's the best place for people to reach you at?
Well, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. So if you look me up, Richard Leftley on LinkedIn, then I'd love to get in touch. And if you have questions, then I really enjoy engaging with people and with the challenges that they face, the ideas that they have. I spend quite a lot of time as well kind of working with a number of universities, kind of thinking about how to overcome some of these challenges, and engaging with the students that come out of those universities has led to kind of some of the best ideas that we've come up with.
That's awesome. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Talking Success, Connecting the Global FinTech Community. Feel free to follow us on LinkedIn at Talent in the Cloud. And if you're interested in exec talent, expanding your team, or you yourself are looking for a new exciting change in your career, check out our website, talentinthecloud.io.